Well, good evening, my dearly beloved brethren and sisters and young people. It's just wonderful to be in the life of this very great man of God, the preeminent character of the Old Testament, who takes up so much of the divine record. And what we're going to do this for the next few classes is, God willing, is to pick up David's life from where we left it off. We were largely at the end of this Absalom period. You can see here the period where Absalom dominates the story. Not that that part of the record is actually all about Absalom, but Absalom sets the scene for that whole period of David's life. The record unquestionably focuses on David, but in fact it is Absalom that sets the scene into which the story is actually woven. You remember that David was told by Nathan, by Yahweh through Nathan, that God would raise up evil against him out of his own house and the sword would not depart. Terrible words that David never ever forgot and could never ever forget, because the consequences of his sin rolled on through his family for many years. In fact, right to the end of his life it rolled on. But for this 12-year period here, which is approximately what it was when Absalom dominated the scene, it was just characterized by the most awful things, as we've seen in previous classes. Deceit and intrigue and treachery and injustice, and it just goes on and on. And David is put through all of that and emerges through the record as an amazing individual whose daily experiences of his life at times are just unfolded for us to see, not for us to judge, but for us to see and to learn from. Well, it's quite remarkable, I think, that near the end of this period, and we're going to pick up, by the way, the story from here in that area there. We've sort of reached this point at the end of Absalom's revolt, when Absalom died late part of chapter 18 and the early part of chapter 19. And we're going to focus our attention over the next few classes in this period of David's life, when he's in his 60s. But what is really interesting is this, I think. And the scripture is a bit like this. It concentrates at times an enormous amount of attention on a very, very small period of time. One example is Josiah's life. If you read carefully the record, there's quite a number of chapters in the historical record, but most of it's actually in 1 year of Josiah's life. And God is not interested in a full, complete history of everyone's life. He's not interested in that. He's interested to tell us something that's actually going to be meaning for us and for every generation that follows. But here, in approximately a three-month period, just around there, over five chapters of this record in 2 Samuel take place. So from about chapter 15, verse 13, right through to the end of chapter 20, all happens in just a few months. Now, there's an enormous amount of intrigue and so on goes on in there, and we've considered quite a bit of that in our classes up until this point. But we're only partway through that story. We're more than halfway through. In fact, we're 90% through the details in the record. But we're only halfway through a journey that David is actually on. And we might ask ourselves, why is there just so much detail recorded here in this period of David's life? And I think the answer to that lies, well, there's a number of answers, I suppose, but one of those things lies that is sort of embedded in what Brother Roberts once said, that crowns are won and lost in the everyday, ordinary things of life, and when circumstances are challenging and difficult, whatever brings that, brothers and sisters, whether it's circumstances of our own cause, of our own choosing, or of our own folly, or whether it's other things outside that happen to us, as happened to David here. It's those times that we develop a closer relationship and a greater trust on God. And that's really what God is after. God is interested in those periods in individuals' lives when the development of their relationship with Him is going at a great rate. And so we find in David's life as a 3-month period that God just opens up for us to see what was happening to David. Do you know, in that period of David's life, it was more prolific in his psalm writing than almost any other period of his life. Now, I say it was more prolific in his writing. That may not be true, but we have more recorded psalms around that period than any other period of his life. And we find those psalms in the mouth of Messiah at the time of his deepest and darkest hour as he approached the end of his life. So God was teaching David a great deal. And we're foolish, brothers and sisters, if we just read over these Sunday school stories and don't actually spend time thinking, what is God trying to show me here? What is God telling us in this record? Well, you know, we got to the point at the end of our last series, which I think was 2 years ago, so I don't expect you to remember all that detail. We got to this point where eventually Absalom, at the end of this 12-year period, eventually Absalom is killed. He's taken out of the way. And you might think, well, finally, the problem's gone. Ha ha ha, no, no, no. It's not plain sailing from here. And the record shows that very, very clearly. It's not plain sailing until the day David lays his head down and falls asleep and is taken to the grave. It's not plain sailing. And nor is it, brothers and sisters, meant to be plain sailing in anyone's life. And we've got to learn that from David too. And while the intensity of that experience with Absalom and through that period is actually now in the past for David, he has been greatly changed and greatly exercised by all of that. You know, and what we find is David emerging. And this is just one example. This is one of the psalms that was written in this period. Psalm 40, where David says, I waited patiently for Yahweh, and he inclined to me and heard my cry. This is probably written near the end of this period, after he had had deliverance from Absalom. Now, he didn't want Absalom killed, but God said, that's the answer, David. Absalom has to be taken out of the way. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay. And he set my feet upon a rock and making my footsteps firm. That's how David interpreted those circumstances. He wasn't whinging and crying. He wasn't complaining about the loss of his son, though it cut him deeply, as it would any father. But his mind was greater than that, brothers and sisters. And that's why these stories are so valuable to us, because we have the mind of a great man behind them to see how he was exercised by all the experiences that God brought upon him. Here's Psalm 109, again, a psalm of that period, unquestionably of that period, very messianic. And but at the end of that psalm he says, help me, O Yahweh my God, O save me according to your mercy, that they may know, everyone else around who is his enemy and who is accusing him falsely and bringing all kinds of treachery against him, that they may know that this is your hand, that you, Yahweh, have done it. Let them curse, but you bless. When they arise, let them be ashamed, but let your servant rejoice. And so he turns, I will greatly praise Yahweh with my mouth. Yea, I will praise him among the multitude. You know, it's almost mind-boggling to see the mind of a man who could be enduring such enormous challenges and difficulties, such opposition, unreasonable opposition of men against himself, to the point that Messiah himself could enter into what David was going through. And at the end of all that, he's saying, I will praise Yahweh with my mouth. I'll praise him. I'll tell of all his wonderful works to everyone. Because what David understood, brothers and sisters, is that it's not those circumstances that should make us happy or not. It's where we stand in relation to God that really matters. It's what those experiences do for us and our relationship to God that's the critical thing in our life. And David understood that. That's why he could praise God in the end. He didn't like any of that trauma. Tears rolled down his eyes night after night after night through that experience when he didn't know where he was going to stop, who was going to catch up with him, what was going to happen, whether he was going to get killed, whether his company was going to get attacked. He didn't know all of those things, brothers and sisters. He had all the anxieties and more than you and I will ever have. And yet, he could still praise God and thank him for all those experiences. This is an amazing story, brothers and sisters. And we're going to pick it up now. We're going to have a look at the big picture. Because this much we've looked at already. You see, David chose to leave Jerusalem. And he retreated from the city, as we know. And on the way, he met Hushai, an old and faithful friend. He met Ziba. He met Shimei. He came to the Jordan and he crossed the Jordan. He went across to Mahanaim. All very deliberate. I think David had planned all of that as he left. But that's where we're at right now. So it's really important to see the framework. But look at what happens in the divine record here, brothers and sisters. This is really interesting to see. That now we're going to see the king come back from Mahanaim. And he comes back to Jordan and then back to Jerusalem. And in the process he meets Shimei and Ziba and Mephibosheth and Barzillai. He doesn't meet Hushai again, but he meets Barzillai. He's a parallel to Hushai. He's old, faithful, unable to journey, just like Hushai. We don't even know whether Hushai was still alive at this stage by the time David got back. But he meets another one. So there's actually some symmetry here. There's a parallel here. This in actual fact, is a biblical chiasmic structure. Who knows what a chiasm is? Put your hands up if you know what a chiasm is. Oh, one. Okay. Two know what a chiasm is. If you've ever had a look at the Bullinger's, what's it called? Companion Bible. He identifies a number of these things. You might have seen these sort of little structures. I'm not going to go into any technicality. A chiasmic structure is not just something that's related to the Bible. There are quite a few chiasmic structures in the Bible, and they're quite interesting when you find them. And I'm absolutely convinced that this is one of them. And it goes right across five or six chapters here. And what happens in a chiasmic structure is there's a repetition of similar ideas or events in a reverse sequence. So there's certain things laid out and then repeated again, but in the reverse order. And you can see that. That's sort of what's happening here. David moves out of Jerusalem across to Mahanaim and back again. And in the process, he meets these people and then those people again in reverse order. You think, well, what's so interesting about that? Well, you know, it's actually a literary device to try and emphasize something. You know, if we're trying to emphasize something, especially if you've got a word processor, you know, bold this word or underline this or put this in flashing colours or whatever. You can highlight things in various ways. Well, in the ancient texts, they couldn't do that, and writers had to rely on using literary devices to actually do that. And this is only just one of those literary devices. But what is very interesting about a chiasmic structure is that it leads you to the emphasis. As you come down this repetition, you get to the centre, and the centre is actually telling us here. That's where the focus is. The focus here is on Mahanaim. Why is the focus on this whole long, big journey of David coming out of Jerusalem, going through all those experiences, and back again to Jerusalem when he's made king, from king taking off the crown out to Mount Naim and back again where the king is crowned again. What's the focus? What's this? You know, it was absolutely no accident that David actually went out to Mahanaim in the first place. You know, if you want to make a note of this, and I think it's worth making a note, 1 Kings 2 verse 8 implies, don't need to look at it up now, but it implies that David actually decided to go to Mahanaim. It wasn't just an accident that he actually went out there, because Mahanaim was a very special place that had been named by Jacob, where he had been assured by God that God was with him, where there were two hosts. Jacob saw his own host, and the host of heaven was opened up to him, and God said, "No, Jacob, I'm with you, and I'm going to look after you." The host of heaven was joined in that place with his host. And now David heads out there, conscious of Jacob's experience, but he too feeling as though he doesn't have the power to control circumstances. Things have gotten way beyond what he is able to do, and he just has to trust. He has to learn to not lean on his own scheming and his own plans that he's done all his life, and he has to just put things in God's hands and accept God's will. And what happened there, brothers and sisters? When he eventually gets out to Mahanaim, David is rescued. He's saved by God from an overwhelming power of and force of evil that was unjustly thrown against him. And here was God's victory. Unquestionably, David couldn't have fought that. David could not have fought that. He had too few men. Everything was going against him. He was weak and powerless. You know, Ahithophel was right. His advice would have crushed David if it had been able to succeed, but God overthrew it. And what happens is that here we find the focus is on God's deliverance out at Mahanaim of all places, which is where Jacob learned to rest on God. Well, that's what David's out there for, because he actually knows he can't deal with this situation, and he's handed it back to God. You know, brothers and sisters, God isn't just interested in saving David merely, or anyone for that matter, but he is very, very interested. In fact, it's his purpose in the lives of the saints to strengthen their faith and their trust in him, so that a relationship between him and them might grow stronger and stronger. That is what God is interested in happening in your life and mine and in David's. And he takes David right out to Mahanaim. And in the process, David is just learning all of those things. You know, David knew many of those principles. He knew about what it was like to trust in God, but it's deepening, and his relationship to God is becoming even deeper. Just turn back a few pages to chapter 15. You know, God could have just dealt with this whole experience. The problem as to why David left Jerusalem in the first place was because Absalom was coming, and he couldn't bear to actually have civil war with his own son, so he actually took off. And when he's leaving, he says this. This is David's word, so we know what his mind is. It's verse 25 of 2 Samuel 15. And the king said to Zadok when he came out with the ark, he said, "No, take it back. If I shall find favor in the eyes of Yahweh, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he does say, 'I have no delight in thee,' behold, here I am. Let him do to me as it seemeth good to him." He's submitting to the will of God. He didn't know the outcome, brothers and sisters. He just trusted that God knew best. And that is the framework that this chiasm is actually showing us. So we're going to pick up the story from here, from Mahanaim, and track back to Jerusalem. But remember, it's really important to get the big overall picture first, so that we know where David is, we know where his mind is, we know what God is doing with him. And so we come now to verse 9 of chapter 19, where we take up our story. Because here, what's happening is that, well, it says, and all the people were at strife. They were arguing, the NIV says. All the people were arguing. There was much confusion. David had come to grips with the death of Absalom. Of course, he was never going to really get over that, but he was ready and able to move on. And the way was clear for him to go back to Jerusalem, but David doesn't move. David does not move. He stays exactly where he is at Mahanaim. Because he wanted the nation to be wanting him to come back. And there's a precedent in that, because you remember when David became king the first time, he'd been anointed many, many, many years before. And Saul eventually was out of the way. And his own tribe, Judah, rallied around him and wanted him to be king. And he was anointed. And again, and he didn't even really want to go up and establish himself. And he asked God, "Shall I go up to Hebron?" And he said, "Yes, go up to Hebron." You know, it was another 7.5 years before the rest of the nation came. And David could have moved in and just said, "Right, you lot, you are all under me, because God has anointed me to be king over you all. And if anyone doesn't want to do that, their head's going to roll and we're going to get this place moving, because I've got plans here." That wasn't David. It wasn't David at all. David waited for years interpreting the mood of the nation, until eventually the nation came to him and said, "David, we're all bone of your bone. We want you to be king." The nation was united under him, and tough, in an amazing time of unity and joy, because David was ready to lead them, and he did. Well, David's in a similar position. He's got lost the confidence of some parts of the nation. And he's been emotionally battered by this whole experience that he's been through. And he's not prepared to just walk in with the sword and start saying, "Now, this is what's going to happen." So he didn't want any more conflict. So verse 9 then says, after there's an argument, and what they were saying is, "The king saved us out of the hand of the enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and now he's fled out of the land for Absalom, and now Absalom's, who's we anointed, is dead. What do we do now? Shall we ask the king to come back?" People were saying yes, people were saying no, some people were saying, "Well, I told you shouldn't go after Absalom," and all sorts of things were going around inside the nation. There was much confusion. And that confusion was to go on for some time as well. You know, and you can understand that confusion, because much of the nation had actually been quite disloyal to David. They'd ended up on the wrong side, and now Absalom's dead and David's alive. And David potentially could come back, and they didn't know what was going to happen. Was David going to come and take vengeance on the nation? Was, you know, where were they? They didn't know where they stood. And so David received some intelligence about what's going on. And one thing that David hated was disunity, absolutely hated it with a passion. And it hurt him at this time that he's hearing stories from some of the other tribes, but from his own tribe of Judah, nothing's coming. No one's saying, "Yes, bring the king back." And that cut David, especially after all that he'd done for his own people, his own tribe, as well as the whole nation. It cut him pretty hard. And verse 11 says, "And the king David sent to Zadok and Abiathar, who were back in Jerusalem, saying, 'Speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel has come to the king?'" Intelligence has been filtering in, and I'm hearing from other parts of the nation that they want me as king, but I don't hear anything from you. "You are my brethren, you are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore are you the last to bring back the king?" There was clearly some tension there, and there had been in the past, and there was going to be more, and it was eventually going to burst out and divide the nation for hundreds of years in the future. But here, we see the seeds of that here. And Judah was particularly hesitant, and you can possibly understand why they were, because Absalom was in Judah. He'd set up his base in Hebron, which was in Judah. And rallied around him were largely the tribe of Judah, and others came in, obviously, as well. And so they're now a bit afraid as to what David might actually do, because they've been foremost in the rebellion. And so David takes the initiative and says, "Why are you holding back? Don't you want me as king?" And that was enough to change them. Verse 14, "And he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word unto the king, 'Return thou and all thy servants.'" You know, David was an amazing individual, and when the people had actually seen that he wasn't going to take vengeance, that he wasn't out to mark men, then they rallied in behind him. Look at verse 13. "He also said, 'And say to Amasa.'" Now Amasa was Absalom's chief general. He was the closest confidant in the military to Absalom, the advisor about how to get David. And he says, "Send this message to Amasa. Art thou not bone of my bone? Art thou not my bone and my flesh?" He was his nephew, actually. "God do so to me and more also, if thou be not captain of the host before me continuing the room of Joab." What an astounding thing. That man should have been tried for treason, and his head should have come off. Under any normal circumstance, there wouldn't have been another king anywhere in those times who wouldn't have had the head of Amasa. And now he says this amazing act of clemency. David offers him Joab's job. This was a king like no other king. And it's not the first. This is not just something out of the blue, you know. Can anyone think of another time when David acted like this? Yes. Yep. Any more? When someone should have lost their head. Yes. Further back. Don't know. Sorry, Absalom. Yeah. What about Abner? Do you know Abner held the nation to ransom and held them away for David for 7 years and fomented problems and difficulties and challenges and opposition so that the nation could never actually come together under David? And when he eventually turned, David just accepted him at face value, welcomed the nation. And then when he was taken out by Joab and Abishai, David gave the most amazing eulogy. He's just a king like no other king. Abner should have lost his head for all that he'd been doing. The underhand opposition against the will of God for those 7 years. And yet he didn't. But this action, this clemency of David, sent a strong message through the whole nation that David's not out for revenge here. David's showing clemency and forbearance. David intends to build the nation. Let's come. Let's go and ask him to come. Because they knew what he was like. He was the one who'd fought all their battles. He was the one that had developed the nation. And kings, he was a king like no other. You know, other kings just, they smashed their way in by might and power, by judgment on their enemies and removing them out of the way. Just take them out. Just remove them. We're not used to living in an environment like that, but such was those times. But not this king. Just hold your hand there and just go over to Isaiah 16. We've been here once before, going some time back. Just have a look at this verse for another reason. But Isaiah 16. I thought I said Jeremiah, did I? Isaiah 16. Isaiah 16 is set in a context of the response of Moab when Christ returns. That's at least its final application. And we read in verse 5, and, you know, talking about how Moab will respond to that, to taking the outcasts from Israel and keeping them from the oppressor. It says, verse 5, "And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth, the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness." It's talking about Christ. But look at the very first phrase. This is talking of Jesus when he comes again. "In mercy shall the throne be established," or prepared. And that's exactly what David was doing. Long before Messiah has a chance to reign, David was enacting that same thing. It's not mercy, the showing of mercy, brothers and sisters, is not a weakness. It seems like a weakness to some who want to just chop heads and defy all opposition and get rid of it. But it will bring men and women to appreciate the value of this man, and then they will accept the judgment and righteousness and truth that he will bring. And that's exactly what it says here, that in the end, that he will sit upon the throne judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. Those things will be the order of the day. But in mercy, the throne is prepared. So here's David foreshadowing Messiah. Verse 14, come back to Samuel. And he bowed. We already read verse 14. So let's go on to verse 15. "And so the king returned and came to Jordan." He was up here at Mahanaim, and he tracked back through the same path that Jacob of old had tracked. And I won't go into that, but if you have a minute, I think picking up the book A Life of David by Harry Tennant, there's a beautiful little section there with talking about the parallel between Jacob and the journey of David here as he moved back down through here, through the Jordan, across. And eventually Jacob ended up at Bethel with the house of God, which is exactly where David's going. The two journeys were really very parallel. But we find that in verse 15 it says, "And Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king and conduct the king over Jordan." Just make a note of this right now, this little phrase, "to conduct the king over Jordan." This conducting over Jordan, or passing over Jordan, it occurs at least 13 or so times in the rest of this chapter. And it's clearly a theme that's happening here. This is going to be symbolic as to what's happening to David. He's going to be coming over Jordan. Now, we know that when Israel came in over Jordan, it was very symbolic. It was symbolic of entering into the inheritance. But there are times when, in the past, warriors crossed across Jordan and then back across Jordan. And so whether you're coming in for the first time or coming back across Jordan, it's coming back to God's inheritance, coming back to God's favour, where his name was. It was the place where God was, and David saw it very clearly like that. And I think that's why it's highlighted so many times throughout the chapter. Without spending any time, Gilgal is mentioned there as a place too, where the kingdom was renewed and where God's deliverance was memorialized. It was a new beginning, and so there was here as well. And so we meet now in verse 16. David comes down to the Jordan itself, down to the fords here. Gilgal is actually back from the Jordan a bit. So David is now down here, right at the fords of Jordan. And there was a number of places where you could cross, where the Jordan's very narrow. And in the past, many warriors and faithful men had been pursuing armies and gone through some of these areas. Well, when David reaches the Jordan, what do you think he expected? What would you expect if you're David? You've been now got these messages from the men of Judah, and other intelligence is saying Israel wants you back. And so he makes this long journey now. He comes back down to Jordan. And who is he expecting to see as he gets there? Who? Would it not be his own tribe and the rest of the nation? But look what happens. Verse 16. "And Shimei, this is the first person he sees. Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, which was of Bahurim. His full bio's there. This is exactly, word for word, the same man. This is not another Shimei. The record tells us that. We knew all that detail about Shimei before, but it tells us exactly who he was so that we have no mistake that this was the same cursing, blasphemous man, the same coward who from a distance hurled dust and insults at David at a time when he was vulnerable. And he hasted and came down with the men of Judah to meet the king of David. Oh, yes, he hasted, all right. And look at what verse 17. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and also Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons, and his 20 servants with him. And they went over Jordan before the king. They're the first ones to get there. And look who's there. We have Shimei and all his mates. 1,000 of them. And Ziba's with him. And all his servants and his family. All lined up. And the record is saying to us, remember what happened before. Because we've met Ziba and we've met Shimei before. And verse 16 and verse 17, if you take the NIV translation, both say he hasted or they rushed down. An urgency that was born of hypocrisy. You see, circumstances had suddenly changed. And so the chameleon needs to change his colours. You just can't stay the same. These two men both saw the writing on the wall if they didn't act fast. They saw the fortunes turn, and so action had to be very, very fast, and they had to get down and make a very good impression, and they had to put some feigned effort into contrition to eat some humble pie. But what a gall both of these men have. They've both read the signs of David's amnesty to his own tribe and to Amasa. And there, look what the record says. It says they hasted and came down with the men of Judah. They're riding on the back of this, hoping that if they bring some great support and strength, if they come down and try and offer to help, that and they attach themselves somehow to the men of Judah, well, David might save their lives. What are these two hypocrites doing in this record? Well, for the same reason, brothers and sisters, that we meet deception and injustice and evil. It just doesn't all go away. God hasn't offered a flower-strewn pathway all our life through to the kingdom. We will experience evil and injustice and hypocrisy. But you see, brothers and sisters, if there were none of those things, there would be no opportunity for us to demonstrate the qualities of God, to show the character of God in the face of evil, if there was no evil. Nor would be there any chance for us to demonstrate the mercy and the compassion and the thankfulness for the good, if that didn't come too. And so just as God deals with the just and the unjust, the good and the evil, so we must, and so must David. And so David, the very first people he meets on this journey back, he meets an outright declared enemy, an arch enemy and a coward. He meets a hypocritical, self-interested deceiver and liar. He meets a faithful, genuine and generous friend. Just the contrast is enormous. But verse 18 says, and then went over a ferry boat to carry. Now, that's probably not very accurate, and most other translations change that. And the ESV says, they crossed at the ford. It's more likely that it's not a ferry boat, it's actually a ford. They crossed at the ford to bring over the king's household. It was an impressive display, and these two men, Shimei and Ziba, had actually gathered 1,035 men, strong men, and they're over in the water and over, ready to take David over and all his household and do anything he wants, and they're bringing him over. And as soon as Shimei gets onto the other side where David is, immediately he's on his face. He's prostrated on the ground. Well, then he makes this confession, or is it a confession? Verse 19, and he said to the king, let my Lord impute iniquity unto me. I'm going to put it up here so that we can see it. We can actually see what Shimei says. He says, and this is from another translation, I can't remember what it's, NIV or something. He says, don't think badly of me, my Lord. Don't recall the sin of your servant on the day that my Lord left Jerusalem. Don't let the king take it to heart. For here's the reason why you shouldn't do all of those things. For I, your servant, know that I've sinned. And I've come here today, the first of all the house of Judah, to come down to meet my Lord the king. That's what David was meant. What did that mean, brothers and sisters? What was he saying? Well, he's saying, essentially, I'm concerned about me. I'm not concerned about you, David. I don't do confessions of sins. I don't outline all my specific sins. I'll keep this general. Don't recall the sin of your servant on the day that my Lord left Jerusalem. He doesn't talk about anything like the blasphemy, the abuse, the hurling of rocks, the violence that he did, the shame that he brought to David. And David being the king of the nation and what damage he'd done amongst all the people and what damage he'd done in the eyes of God. He never thought about any of that, and he never mentioned one single whit of that, brothers and sisters. And when we generalize like Shimei does, we never really come to grips with it. And until we actually have to sit down and think exactly what the problem was, we don't come to grips with our sin. And so he says to David, don't take it too seriously. For look, I know I sin. You don't need to worry about this. I'm a bad boy. I've come down here, and I'm down here with my mates to help you. So that, can we forget it after this? That's the mind of Shimei. Do you think David didn't see through that? I think David did see through that. But look what he does, brothers and sisters. He writes the script. David, don't you think badly of me. Don't you recall, and don't you take it to heart. He's telling David what he should do. Has he been in any position to do any of this? Oh, this is a creep, brothers and sisters. Just about makes your blood boil to hear a man and to see him prostrated before a man like David after what he's done to him. It's just astounding, really. Nothing like the man he's standing before who was concerned about cleansing his sin, about the inward parts, about God's part in all that and purging him, about the man whose spirit has no deceit. Spirit! What did Shimei know of spirit? What did he know about the mind? I'll confess my transgression. And to this cause, everyone who is godly shall pray to you. Well, Shimei is not of that ilk. Shimei is 1,000 miles from that, brothers and sisters. I don't have any doubt that that David saw through Shimei's charade. But how did he respond? Well, you know, early he had already shown clemency to Judah and to Amasa. Because David's conscious of his own need for mercy. On that day, David was very conscious that God had brought him deliverance, that his life was in the balance, and that if it had not been for an amazing, miraculous victory wrought by God, then David's life wouldn't have even been there. So God had saved his life and had now given him the opportunity to come back to Jerusalem to take the throne again and to welcome his people and to be back in fellowship with God in the place that he loved. And David had a choice that day, brothers and sisters. It's like a choice we have every day. He had a choice. Well, he could just execute judgment. What is right? And if anyone had taken off Shimei's head, no one would have complained that he was wrong. Or he could show mercy and stand to be criticized by some people. And even though Shimei was an outright blasphemer and evil man, David that day, conscious of God's incredible victory, David chose to extend mercy. He gives the reason in verse 22. He says, the end of that, he says, halfway through, "Shall any man be put to death this day in Israel? For do not I know that I am this day king over Israel?" You know, a few days ago, he wasn't king over Israel. And he realized that the only reason he was now is because God had rescued him and put him back in that position. He didn't expect it. He didn't deserve it. But God had shown mercy. And that day, he was not prepared to take a harsh judgment against anyone, even if they deserved it. Because he wrote around about this time, whether it's exactly this time or it's in the latter part of his life, he wrote Psalm 103, in which he said, "Yahweh has not dealt with us after our sins, nor rewarded us according to our iniquities." So David decided to act like his God. But before David could even answer Shimei, Abishai interrupts verse 22. Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this because he's cursed Yahweh's anointed?" And David said, "What have I to do with you, sons of Zeruiah, that you should be adversaries unto me? Shall there any man be put to death in Israel? Don't you understand?" You know, Abishai was right, brothers and sisters. Shimei did deserve to lose his head. And David later told Solomon, "He should lose his head, Solomon. I didn't do it. There was a reason I didn't. But don't let him go to the grave without coming down in blood." And David's reaction to Abishai seems really quite harsh, I suppose, on the surface. You know, the NIV says, "What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah?" You know, that's the second time David said that. The second time he actually said it to Abishai. When was the other time, do you know?
When he left Jerusalem.
When Shimei's over on the hill, cursing and swearing and throwing rocks and humiliating David, Abishai alongside, he says, "David, just let me take one swipe." And he says, "No, you're too hard for me. What have you and I got in common?" Of God says he can curse, Caleb, curse. Abishai is saying, what? I don't understand this. Like, the man's just needs his head taken off. He needs that mouth closing. And so twice, this is what happened when he left. Abishai assessed the situation. He responded in a logical and fleshly way, a normal way that most people would have. Yes, let me go and take his head off. And David says, no, you don't understand. No, Abishai didn't understand. No one understood that David at that time was on a journey. He's on a journey alone of submission to the will of God and to evil. And he outworks a Christ-like response in the process. It may be that Yahweh will requite me for good for his cursing this day. Abishai and Job didn't understand what he's talking about. But when he comes back, brothers and sisters, now he's confronted again with this man. And David's response is just the same, and Abishai's is just the same. He looks at it, David, you know, look, shouldn't he be put to death? He should have been put to death back when we saw him first time. What now? David says no. David, feeling unworthy himself, feeling thankful for God's mercy, knowing that mercy rejoices against judgment, he takes a path, brothers and sisters, that no man should be put to death that day. It's quite astounding, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Because what we're seeing here in David is a man who was spiritually strong enough to not have to defend his own honour. Saving Shimei's life had nothing to do with Shimei's worthiness. Shimei deserved to die. But here's a great man using mercy, choosing mercy to build and to restore. And Abishai and Joab are on another wavelength. That's why he said to them, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zerah, that you should this day be adversaries? That you should be Satan to me? Get behind me, Satan. It's exactly the situation that Jesus met with Peter when he told him to get behind him. For thou savourest not the things that be of God, but the things of men. They're interpreting things just from a natural point of view. They didn't see any bigger picture. They didn't see any higher principle. Just like Peter didn't actually see at the time. But was later to see. But here's David, 1,000 years ahead of his time, showing the spirit of Christ in the face of evil. It's quite astounding, isn't it, brothers and sisters, that we find here this amazing thing. You know, and it's only in the face of great challenges and difficulties, only in the face of evil circumstances, brothers and sisters, that we have the opportunity to be the children of our Father. So we shouldn't think it strange that difficult things happen in our lives. We shouldn't think it strange. We should rejoice and thank God there's an opportunity for us to respond. You know, I suppose it's sort of like almost a daily thing. Our motives, we can choose to, like Brother Michael was speaking on Sunday about Jesus coming not to destroy but to save. You know, we have to change our level of thinking, brothers and sisters. David was on a different level. And if we are actually thinking about saving rather than destroying, what will happen? The choice will be ours to take as to how we respond in whatever circumstance. So David swore to Shimei that day, though he was suspicious and told Solomon so later. But what we have here, I think, in the record, brothers and sisters, is an amazing sort of situation outlined. And I'm not going to leave this up. I'm just going to move on because I just want to finish with one other thing before we do finish. But we have here portrayed, and if you're interested, you can get these slides afterwards, but here's the ugliness of sin personified. And I think, you know, brothers and sisters, you know, in a class, we can't absorb and assimilate just the depth of what we really need to do without meditation. I think we need to take that list. This is Shimei, who falsely accused people, ran people down from a safe distance. That's what he did. Doesn't matter whether we say it or throw stones or whether we just think it, brothers and sisters. If we're at a safe distance and we're thinking evil or saying evil of our brethren, no different to Shimei. It's just the degree. But look at the characteristics of that man. And when we look at this is what we're looking at. This is us. That is sin. It's horrific. You know, my blood just about boils and my skin creeps when I think about Shimei on the ground before David. And yet that's actually how we've got to see sin. And Shimei is no, Steve is no different. Because here's a man who, well, he told lies to benefit himself. That's basically where it started. You ever told a lie to benefit yourself? Ever then cultivated an outward persona that actually is different from the inside so that you can cover that? And so that everyone thinks we're fine when we're actually not? That's sin working its deceptive magic in our lives, brothers and sisters. And until we gaze into the mirror of the word, until we look carefully at individuals like this and say, I hate that with a passion, and I see it in me, they will never change it. You know, Jeremiah 17 says, the heart of man is deceitful, Ziba, and incurably bad, Shimei. Who can know it? But the next verse says, I, Yahweh, search the heart and the mind to reward every man according to his deeds deserve. Now, these two men got not what they deserved straight away. They didn't even realize God had penetrated their mind and their hearts. But we don't want to be like. There's a very powerful, powerful lesson. I think we might stop there. We'll pick up, just right at the end, we'll pick up the story about Mephibosheth and Barzillai and the start of the next class, and push on into the next chapter.